Hello and welcome to this special episode of Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Today is the first installment in a series celebrating the truth tellers in our community. So why are we celebrating truth tellers? Well, apparently these days it can take a lot of bravery just to state simple truths on controversial issues like homelessness, substance abuse, public safety, COVID-19, and government mandates. And so we want to take time to recognize, sit down, and chat with people who have found that inner courage to speak truths, regardless of what it might mean for them personally, politically, or professionally. Today, our truth teller is one of my favorite mayors. And actually, tomorrow, she's going to be delivering her State of the City address. I'm talking about Kent Mayor Dana Ralph. One of the reasons why Mayor Ralph is one of my favorite mayors is I think she is among a small group of politicians that truly tries to do their job in a nonpartisan way, battling a lot of different competing interests, and in her case, being the mayor of a city that sits in the shadow of Seattle. The following segment is presented in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org.
I think you're one of the mayors who's been a little more realistic in the last few years about how things have gone. Yeah. You know, you and I chatted a lot during the pandemic about the challenges to businesses. We've talked a lot about the challenges with crime. Mm-hmm. So I know mayors like to sort of assign the state of the city is blank. I won't make you give it away, but how do you feel like your city is doing?
I think we're doing okay. I think there are a lot of really good things that are happening in the city of Kent, and we have a lot of challenges, the same challenges that we're seeing across the state. So I'm optimistic, but realistic at the same time.
Let's start with the business environment, because when we go back to COVID, I think that was one of the chief complaints is you as a mayor felt like, and you were willing to say that you felt like you were cut out of the equation and almost helpless to help struggling businesses. Has there been a market rebound for businesses since that period of time?
Yeah, absolutely. We, especially in the Industrial Valley in Kent, have seen pretty consistent growth, adding square footage, somewhere over 2 million square feet of space in the Industrial Valley, new businesses moving into Kent. As things are, the combination of pricing in, say, Seattle or Bellevue are going up, Kent, we're still in that market. And we've got space, and I think it is still, you know, crime's under control, more so than in other places. How about that?
All right, we're going to get to that assertion that crime is under control.
It's not necessarily,
yeah. When you look back at that period of time during the pandemic and that kind of feeling of helplessness, have you done any sort of debrief with the governor's office or with folks about, have they come to you to do a debrief about how all that went and frustrations around closures, et cetera?
There has not been any conversation about that process. I think I was pretty vocal during the time that as a city, we were sort of at the bottom of that food chain, right? The state was making decisions, the county was making decisions, and we were all on the receiving end. So that frustration still exists about that process, how things went and the lack of communication. Was just talking to one of our business owners again about all of the impacts of not knowing day to day. So it's still, the frustration is still real.
Well, that's frustrating for me to hear, because I think I, at the beginning of the pandemic, just gave people the benefit of the doubt because it was this really weird situation. But when you have an opportunity in hindsight to go back and to say, if this happens again, how do we do it better? It feels like a missed opportunity to not go to cities and say, hey, what worked, what didn't work? I mean, what would you tell the governor today or a future governor about if this happens again, which hopefully not, what needs to happen to make it easier for our mayors?
I think communication, being involved in decision-making, what's working, what's not working. There were a lot of things that were done to cities, just like they were done to businesses and residents, right? Without that sort of back and forth. And so as different restrictions or regulations were coming across, we had challenges in the practical application, whether it be just monitoring our own employees and how we did notifications around COVID, things like remote meetings, and how a city had to provide for public access. So we are really big fans of that in Kent. We've been doing it for a long time, but just some of the regulations about having to have somebody in a building so it can be open if you're doing something all remote, that puts a staff member at risk. I mean, there's just all of these things that I think a debrief would have brought to the surface.
You could do it at the city level though, right? Anything stopping you guys from doing your own debrief?
So we've absolutely worked through all of that. Like what worked with our employees? How did it affect departments? What were ways that we were able to continue to provide services? I think we've got some great examples and some things that we would have done differently.
Did you guys have a vaccine mandate?
We did not. My personal belief on the vaccine mandate is I am an elected official. I am not a doctor. And it was not something that I should will on my employees. And we knew fairly early on that the idea that being vaccinated didn't mean you couldn't get or pass COVID. So I was struggling with the whys, right? Why am I going to impose this on someone? And so we did not do a mandate.
Well, and I think in hindsight, it's very clear. It doesn't mean, and this is the thing too, it doesn't mean you're anti-vax by saying,
correct,
like, anti-vax mandate. People have a hard time bifurcating those two opinions because you can be both. And we've seen in hindsight that that was the correct decision not to mandate it and to maybe incentivize it. And even did that extend to your fire agencies too, do you know?
So we have an RFA in Kent, so separate entity. Fire did have a vaccine mandate. But for the city, for all of our city employees, our police department, all of our public works employees, we did not.
We've heard a little bit from the mayor of Seattle about what they're trying to do to revitalize downtown. Some of it I agree with, some of it I don't agree with. But have you guys given any special incentives or breaks to businesses to fill any vacant storefronts you had because of the pandemic?
So we are doing something a little different than that. We've got, we took some of our ARPA funding, that money that came from the federal government, and put it into what's called the Flex Fund, which gives businesses access to capital that maybe wouldn't necessarily be successful in a traditional banking market. So lower interest rate, different qualifications, partner them up with business coaches is probably the best, community navigators. So we are able to lend money for them to do capital improvements, startup, expansion, that kind of thing. A couple million dollars so far has gone out in the city of Kent in this program. And we're feeling like that's a better way to support our businesses and give them that long-term stability.
I'm curious what kind of businesses are qualifying for that when you say maybe wouldn't traditionally be good in the banking system.
So Kent has a significant number of immigrant and refugee business owners, so not a lot of long-standing credit history, not entrenched in sort of that traditional banking system. It tends to be more along that lines. Really small businesses, micro businesses, entrepreneurs, that kind of thing are who we're seeing benefiting.
So not really, because just to be frank, an issue I took with what the mayor of Seattle said recently is they're prioritizing business owners of color for some of the vacant storefronts, which to me, I look at the mayor and I think, how can you afford to be picky based on the color of someone's skin when you have blocks upon blocks of vacant storefronts that have been completely taken over? So is that a program that's prioritizing immigrants and people of color, or it's just helping?
I think it's helping. And we do have community navigators. So we've got both the Chamber of Commerce and then the Indian Association of America, IACS. And so we've got navigators that help a variety of different types of businesses, but I really see that more as sort of an equal playing field. So there's access to all businesses. It's not a, you must be a BIPOC business owner to access this program.
Gotcha. Because you mentioned like entrepreneurs, yep, and stuff, which
exactly
would encompass people of all races.
Everybody.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Why would I, as a small business, I mean, I am a small business looking to relocate right now. So why would Kent be a place that a small business would choose as opposed to anywhere else on this side of the mountains?
I would say that we are supportive of our businesses. We provide access to all of the resources the city has through economic and community development. We do a lot of partnership making, working to connect our businesses to help build capacity, information and knowledge. And we also, we're in a great location, right? We're right in between Seattle and Tacoma, easy access off the freeways, still have good real estate options available for folks, and we're continuing to grow. So pretty long list of reasons why I think people should choose Kent.
Yeah, and I do think having a mayor that stands up for businesses is helpful. I just had a business owner from Ballard in the other day who is beside himself. Nobody's listening to him. He's got people passed out in his alcove all the time, and police come, they can't do anything. And so, you know, to have a mayor who vocally is like going to bat for you, I do think it is important in the political climate. And also on the issue of public safety, you mentioned Kent's doing better than some.
So maybe let's preface that comment and sort of dig into that a little bit. We are focused more than some. We are still bound by the same rules and laws that are created by the legislature, of which, we've been pretty outspoken about during this legislative session. And we are hampered a little bit by, you know, what King County is willing to charge, all of those kinds of things. But we are one of the first cities in the state to have filled all of our vacant positions in the police department.
Okay.
We are making progress in that front. We put a lateral bonus in place before any other city, which attracted a significant number of laterals to
How
the
much?
City, $25,000. Okay. That was last October, a year ago October, so before that became the popular thing to do. And we settled a contract with our union to make them one of the highest paid agencies in the state. All of that because we knew we needed to fill those vacancies. With reform that came in 21, we saw about a third of our officers leave. Right, they just left the profession. They moved to other states. One of my best neighborhood response officers became a real estate agent because the liability, the climate was not wasn't a good place to be as somebody who was trying to serve your community. So just on that front, we did a lot of creative things with recruiting, filling that force up. So when I say it's still going to take time. It's taking 8, 9, 10 months to get through the academy. So it's 18 months to get an officer on the street, but we're making progress in that front.
Yeah. It's not 25% of your force down like Seattle.
Right. We filled up, we don't have enough positions. Washington State ranks 51 in the number of officers per capita, which is absolutely, it should be shameful to everyone. But in the framework that we have, the funding that we have, we are fully staffed.
How many officers is fully staffed?
166.
Gotcha. So you mentioned the legislative session, mm-hmm. which is ongoing. I've had a lot of frustration around the pursuit law. What is your position on where that law should be at the end of the session?
So I am really supportive of Rep. Rule's proposal. I think that she did the right thing. I'm frustrated. I feel like we've made a tiny bit of progress. They've added DV in domestic violence into that pursuit, but things like stolen vehicles, without that, I don't think we've made a ton of progress. I mean, we know that the bad guys are stealing cars and using them to drive through businesses, commit other crimes. The reality is we can't continue at this pace of nearly 50,000 cars stolen a year in the state.
Yeah, and just to give folks a little bit of context for the Alicia Rule bill, which was one of the bipartisan bills that came through the House, and she's a Democrat. She had Republican support on that bill, and then there was a substitute bill that watered it down a bit. Mm-hmm. So basically, they're just, under the current consideration, there are, I think, 6 types of crimes that officers could pursue under if it passes. So I think it's any type of violent crime, domestic violent, violence assault, escape from justice. Oh, now I'm going to
blank
on the DUI. A vehicular assault is one, and then I'm missing one, but it doesn't include anything for stolen vehicles. There has been an assertion from some Democrats, you know, Senator Monica Dingra, we've been just driving the issue home with her because she's sort of like, show me the data that suggests that the current pursuit law is making crime worse. And in my mind, I'm like, well, I don't know how that data can exist because then I would have to tie someone who drove off and know everything that they went on to do. And that's hard. I would argue it's almost impossible. So if you were chatting with someone like Senator Dingra or other Democrats who support the fix from 2021 and don't want to change, how could you articulate to them how that has contributed to the crime crisis?
I mean, I think we do have some proof in that every jurisdiction has the 911 tape of the person calling back. We've had it happen in Kent. Tell your officers to stop pursuing me. They're not allowed to. That in and of itself, to me, feels like that should be the only thing we need to say.
It's wild.
It's crazy.
It's wild.
Just we know what we're seeing, right? Since July of 21, the number of stolen vehicles has gone up. The number of crimes being committed with stolen vehicles has gone up. So we're seeing, like I said, we're seeing people steal a car. They use it. They drive through. It just happened in Edmonds or Linwood this week. They use that stolen vehicle to drive through a business. They try and steal things. They get back in the car. And once they're back in the car, they're then safe, essentially. And the problem is there. I've heard a lot of conversation about, well, you can find them later. Well, if you're in a stolen vehicle and I don't know who you are, I don't know how to find you later, right?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense to me. And we know that all of these crimes are going up, and they're rising at a much faster rate in the state of Washington than they are anyplace else.
Yeah, and there was just that horrible case. I don't know if you heard about it. We talked about it early on the podcast. In Sunnyside, there was a guy going 110 miles an hour. Yep. They couldn't pursue him because that's not allowed under the law. He went and killed two kids in a car crash. I mean, that's horrifying.
It's replaying itself over and over in every jurisdiction. We had a stolen vehicle with one of our neighboring cities that they knew was stolen. We're sitting there waiting on it. The guys got back in the car. They couldn't pursue. Ended up crashing that car, carjacking two more cars before they crashed. That's two carjackings that could have been prevented had they been able to stop that stolen vehicle in the beginning.
Yeah, I thought it was a no-brainer heading into the legislative session that they would fix this thing in a meaningful way. And now, like, as the weeks go by, I'm more and more depressed about it. I mean, something is better than nothing.
That's the position that we're taking. We're going to continue to, as it works through the process, I will continue to testify. Our chief will continue to testify. And we'll take whatever changes we can get, and we'll keep working on it.
Yeah. In the South King County, mayors and chiefs have been very outspoken. Is there an element of feeling like you're just sort of always living in Seattle shadow on these issues? Like your voice just down there collectively does not matter as much.
I think that's why you've seen us come together as a South County to elevate that voice, because that's sort of been the way that South County is treated for decades. So making sure that folks understand. Mayor Backus said this in a meeting the other day, that we're sort of the canary in the coal mine, right? When things happen in South County, it's just a matter of time before you start seeing them in other places. So we were the first ones in 21 to be really vocal about a couple of the reforms. Always preface that with, I 100% believe that there were reforms necessary in policing. Many of them we had embraced already. That is not saying that, but it's these kinds of very, very pursuits. Pursuits are a part of catching bad guys. We need to be clear about what's making a difference. There's a traffic stop bill. That traffic stop bill does not make any sense.
You're referring to the one that would disallow officers from pulling someone over for a non-moving violation.
Yes.
For like a expired tab or an equipment violation.
Yep.
For you, why does that not make sense?
Traffic stops are one of the ways that a lot of times we find guns, drugs, people with warrants. We saw something really terrible happen in Tennessee, so we should just stop this other thing. They're not related. That's a human thing. How do we deal with the actions of those people involved and take that on, as opposed to just saying, oh, it's the traffic stop. It's not the traffic stop. And we know that as we've taken these sort of traffic type rules away, we're seeing more accidents. We're seeing more fatal accidents. Fewer people are paying attention while they're driving, and that's only creating a more dangerous society.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, what happened in Memphis and also, you know, previously what happened in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
As sort of the driver to some of these police, quote unquote, reform efforts in our state. In your community, what is the trust level like between the community and the police? Because you do have, I would say, probably more so than a lot of communities, a higher population of people of color, because
mm-hmm.
you have a lot of immigrants there. So what do you think the trust level is like?
I think the trust level is solid. It's something that we've been working on for a very long time, making sure we're doing significant outreach. But the less time our officers have to spend building those relationships, the harder it is to maintain that. And I mean that in a sense of staffing. We just don't have enough officers for the level of crime that we've got going on in the community for them to do the fun things like stop and play a game of basketball or read a story or be at a community event. It's hard to maintain that. But I will tell you, I am hearing from my communities of color on a daily basis, they are afraid. They are the victims of crime. So we're doing this trade-off, like, in order to protect people, we're going to sacrifice other people. And that doesn't make any sense, right? When I have parents saying, I'm afraid for my kids to go to school or walk down the street, I don't understand where those voices fall as decisions are being made.
Yeah. And you had a test as mayor, was it last year or the year before, with community trust in policing? You had that police commander who putting like Nazi insignias and
yeah.
names and stuff on his door. Take me through the decision process there as mayor in trying to deal with that in a way that was legal but also, you know, reflected what you knew needed to happen with him.
Very, very tough days in our community for sure. So as all of that came to light, the initial decision to reprimand was really based on case law that exists in Washington State. We had really solid outside representation that said you can terminate him and take this to arbitration and you will lose and he will be put back to work. And he'll be back, put back to work with a bubble around him, because then any action we would take could be considered retaliation. It was, I don't even know how to put it into words, the agonizing decision process that we went through as a leadership team at the city in order to try and strike some sort of balance with sending a message that this behavior is not at all acceptable and okay, and then also putting this risk of then having this officer there that it's part of the community and having no ability to discipline or terminate. So we made that decision early on to do the reprimand. And then that also helps sort of build that case, right? Which is what our employment law in the state of Washington requires, that you have progressive discipline. It was not the right choice. I've been pretty open about that. It's, we needed to terminate him then and take our lumps. But in the end, we ended up coming to a settlement with him to make sure that he was not a part of our community any longer. Chief was very open about it. I was very open about it. We worked through a process. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of people, including me, that are still not happy that we had to pay him. But it wasn't worth having him, because it did. It eroded trust in our department significantly based on the actions of one person.
Yeah, and it's tough because it is a situation that there was a lot of nuance, but the media, the public doesn't deal with nuance very no. well. And so, you know, I'm very against performative politics of any kind. And firing him, in a sense, would have been performative because you knew on the back end he'd get his right. job back. So it was almost right. like sending a message. And so that was sort of the struggle is, do we send a message knowing he's going to get his job back, or do we try to find another yeah. avenue? I mean, has there been any significant fallout from all of that, do you think?
I think that the community at large, not just in Kent, but across the country, I heard from people all around the world, was anger, justifiable anger, frustration. I think you hit it on the head. The nuance is really hard to describe in a soundbite, in a headline. And so all of the investigation was not also able to, this wasn't, it should have never happened, but we were also trying to handle it in a way that made sense and fit within the law. Because I agree, performative politics, doing something just so I can say that I did it, doesn't mean that it's the right decision.
Yeah. Are you worried that whole thing is going to follow you around?
It will.
Yeah.
It will. It's already, I mean, it's still out there, right? I got another email this last week. So it's been over a year, and it will be, but I can also stand tall and say, you know what? This is what we did. We took a look at that decision. I think any decision maker, if you aren't willing to re-look at things and say, I've got new information and make a different decision, I don't think they're worth their salt. And we made the decision and we did the right thing. And I am very, very proud of my police department and the officers that we have.
Well, what you said there is important, and it's lacking in politics, this willingness to just say, we were wrong.
Yeah.
Like we screwed up. And you did say that. And that's like, I know it's a different subject, but on the pandemic, I just wish there had been some along the way, like, hey, we tried that, didn't work, our bad. I just feel like that's such a more honest way to approach yes. things. It's like not perfection, but really quickly, I want to talk about homelessness and, yeah. and substance abuse. This was also something that we've talked about with, you know, King County, you know, scooping up hotels and like putting people there. And you're like, well, we don't have any say over this as a city. Where are you guys at with your homelessness, which I think is a drug crisis, yeah. but...
So I think we absolutely have a mental health crisis and a drug crisis, and that plays into the homelessness crisis. We are continuing to, so the city of Kent is not a funding partner with the Regional Homeless Authority, but we are working with them. I believe in establishing relationships, and that helps build trust, right? So we're at the table, we're continuing those conversations, but in the city of Kent, we've passed a couple of different ordinances that don't allow camping in sensitive areas or in parks or on sidewalks, that kind of thing. Our city council made some really tough decisions last year to sort of stand up for that. We continue to do outreach. We have, through some of the funding that came from the state a couple of years ago, 1590 funding, the city of Kent chose to take that funding and bring it into the city instead of it going to the county. So we've got a crisis responder team working with our fire department, caseworkers, substance abuse folks that our police department can refer people to. Just started that program, so I'm hopeful. But at the end of the day, we're going to continue to get people into, attempt to get them into the treatment they need, but also not allow camping.
We'll get back to our special series on truth tellers in just a moment. But first, I want to tell you about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I've been talking about them on the podcast, posting about them on social media. I mean, I am a walking, talking billboard for the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I left TV News 2021. And apparently, since I wasn't on TV all day, I just sat at home and snacked and stuff during the pandemic, gained 42 pounds. This past November, I'm like, that's ridiculous. So I set out to lose the weight. I'd heard about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic on the radio. I lost almost 30 pounds in 2 months. It wasn't magic. It was hard work, but I was committed to it. And there was a plan. Dr. Ryan Coogan made it so easy. I had an app on my phone. Having a little accountability really went a long way for me. I've heard from so many of you who have started the program who are already seeing great results. So if you think it might be for you, just schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan. He'll tell you if he thinks it's a program that could benefit you. And if it isn't a program that could benefit you, he'll tell you that as well. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Tell them you heard about them on the Undivided podcast. Dr. Ryan Coogan, DC, results may vary.
On the push and pull between agencies and jurisdictions, there are a lot of cities, even Seattle, having a challenge with the state right now. There's these encampments popping up on state right-of-ways, DOT property. States are just letting them fester, and then the cities deal with the consequences. Do you have any of those on your radar right now?
So we don't have any significant DOT camps. Okay. There is some unincorporated area in between Kent and Auburn that we're working with the county on. I'm hopeful that that camp has gotten out of control. I've been pretty vocal about it, as has been the mayor of Auburn. But in the last few weeks, month or so, we've been working with the county on bringing that to a resolution. It sits in this sort of no man's land in between our cities and then has impacts on both of them. So optimistic on that front. But it is frustrating. We, you know, when a city, I've been following the Spokane story. I feel for the mayor because she doesn't have the ability to do things, and her residents don't necessarily understand that it's not their jurisdiction.
Yeah, well, you have the political will to make a decision, but you can't because it's not your property. And you're right. It goes back to that issue of nuance, which we're just not very good at in the media in particular, is explaining the nuance of those situations. There are two big things coming up, one sooner than the other. In April, King County voters are going to get to decide on a $1.25 billion property tax levy to help deal with substance abuse issues. And then the governor is pushing for this $4 billion housing initiative that would be on the ballot in November. What is your level of support for both or either of those things?
The county initiative, I will tell you, I signed in as a part of the pro statement.
Okay.
I did that for some very specific reasons. I had an opportunity to go with a group. It's been, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago now. Our chief, the mayor of Auburn, and that chief, Representative Tina Orwell, we went to Tucson and visited what this proposal is modeled after. So it's a 23-hour crisis facility that anyone can access. It's called a No Wrong Door program. So whether it's you that are in a mental health or substance abuse crisis, or a child, an elderly parent, or somebody that the police come in contact with, walk in the door and you are immediately triaged into a care process. We had an opportunity to watch a police officer drop someone off, a juvenile drop them off, 6 minutes from the time they pull up to the time that they've handed them off and put them into care. It's very, very impressive, and it's working really, really well in Arizona. So I am supportive of this. I have been also very much asking questions and working to make sure that this ballot measure meets those standards, right? I want this kind of program here. And I'm pretty comfortable that that's what we'll be seeing.
Before we go into the state one then, my hesitancy has been that I feel like King County, we have an executive who's in his fourth term. The homeless crisis has gotten so much worse under his leadership. And I feel like at some point they have to prove that they can use money to good effect. Yeah. And I just haven't seen as a taxpayer any results to show for the tens of probably billions at this point of dollars that they've already spent trying to deal with this crisis. So from someone who supports it, who's been to Tucson, who's seen what it's modeled after, help me as a skeptical citizen believe that the money will be spent well, and at the end of the day, we'll have something to show for it.
Yeah, I will tell you, I'm on the same place, right? We keep spending money and we're not seeing a lot of results. The reason I support this is that this model brings results. It's been demonstrated in Phoenix and in Tucson, in Texas. They're working to open a center in Montana and Alaska.
But so, Phoenix, Tucson, Texas, Montana, Alaska, they are not Seattle politically.
They are not. No, correct. So what I can tell you is that you have a group of other electeds around the county that continue to push towards this. So we were sitting on the Regional Policy Council. So what went to the ballot, we had a chance to put our fingerprints on. The implementation plan, we will be putting our fingerprints on. So I am taking a little bit of a leap of faith and believing, and it's going to be run by, my hope is the same company that is doing this work in other states. So it's not going to be King County employing and running. It is going to be an outside agency, and that also gives me some hope. And those are all questions that I've been asking all the way through.
Yeah, because even though you and some other mayors who I think have the common sense necessary to deal with these issues, if it were entirely up to you, I think if we handed this issue over to South King County to deal with, our results would be far better. But we're sitting here talking today about how you guys just get ignored. Yeah. And so, like, even if your hands are going to be in it, I feel like, but they just ignore you guys on everything else anyway. So it worries me.
Yeah. I'm absolutely in support of this in concept. And so now it's up to mayors like me to continue to work with this, with King County to make sure that it is what it needs to be. It's a resource that as a community, we are desperately in need of. We talk about this. I could walk out of here if I broke my arm and probably get to 10 urgent cares within walking distance. There's no place to go if you're in a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
It's a solid model, and I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, it's tough because I don't want to be so negative as to have you think or someone think that we don't need to do anything or we can't do anything, so you have to spend money. I mean, I get it. We're going to have to spend money to dig ourselves out of the hole that has been created. It's just, it's a hard pill to swallow when so much money has gone to waste. And on that subject, you know, the $4 billion the governor wants, I did an interview with him a couple months ago about it. It scares me that he thinks housing is the solution because I just don't. I guess, do you fall down in a different way on that $4 billion proposal?
I am struggling with the fact that I think it is absolutely real that we need to increase density in cities. That just makes sense. The population's growing. We have to have options. I don't think that it solves the homelessness crisis. The fact that these things continue to be tied together, I mean, I do think there's a certain portion of the population that, you know, if there were different types of housing available, they would not be homeless, but it doesn't solve the mental health issues. It doesn't solve the substance abuse issues. It doesn't fix those that just choose to live outdoors because they don't have to follow any rules. I mean, that doesn't solve those things. So I don't think it solves it. And we're seeing some bills coming through the legislature that we're absolutely working to get amendments to try and make them better. But as I have testified, I have huge concerns because we're not looking at the whole picture. When you take, there's a particular bill that would allow 6 units per single family lot. Yeah. So I don't have the ability to provide the infrastructure for that. Water, sewer, public safety, all of those kinds of things. And it doesn't mean it's affordable. In a place like South King County, naturally occurring affordable housing goes away because it's a lot easier to tear down a $300,000 or $400,000 house and build 6 than it is, say, on the east side where it's $1 million house. So it's not meeting the purpose.
Yeah, I'm already against the $4 billion thing unless there's some. I'd like to see it flipped on its head a little bit. You know, he said, because he keeps peppering in, oh, but we'll also have, you know, supportive services and, you know, for people who are in the midst of a drug or mental health crisis. And it's like, well, I'd like to see more money to that, less money to housing. I mean, I do think we need more housing, but as you pointed out, like more workforce housing, for instance, right. is a totally separate issue. Like we, if you're working hard or you're a two-income household, you should be able to buy a house in the state you live in. And I think that's a much different topic than the people, you know, in the throes of addiction on our streets. I'm going to ask you to sort of do a little preview of the speech that you're going to give, but my viewers would not forgive me if I don't ask you about this drama I went through with the city of Kent. There was supposed to be a women's wellness conference on the 8th. Put on by the Kent Chamber of Commerce. And now were you going to be part of it at all?
I was going to attend.
You were going to attend. It's been canceled.
Yes, it has.
Which I kind of feel bad about. I don't know that they had to outright cancel it, but for people who aren't familiar, you know, I was supposed to give a keynote address, was told it wouldn't be political, would get to talk about empowering women, and then, you know, I got a phone call peppering me on all these political beliefs I don't even hold, you know, being a Trump supporter and just wild stuff. And so I bowed out of giving the keynote and they ended up canceling it. You were very nice and you called me, even though that was not your decision making. And we had a nice conversation about just where we're at as a society where you have to prove like this purity. And one of the first things that struck me about it is I feel like you and I are pretty in step with our political beliefs. You're probably a little more to the left than I am. And so I just thought, man, I'm getting peppered about whether I'm too extreme for this conference when, like, the mayor and I agree on so many things. For you, as a white woman who's a moderate politically, I guess just how did that strike you, that the kind of hurdles I was being asked to jump over to participate in that event?
Frustrating, which is why I reached out.
Yeah.
Getting to be sort of in the middle or maybe 10 feet back from the conversation, I understand why the chamber director did what she did. I understand why you did what you did. I'm frustrated with those that were asking the questions because it's not a thing. It shouldn't be a thing. We're trying to ascribe labels and put people in boxes that don't make any sense. And the goal of that conference was women's empowerment. So whatever political beliefs you hold don't fit into that conversation, right? You've taken big steps in your career. You're a shining example for women that take their destiny into their own hands. And to me, that's what I was excited to hear about. I don't think it was appropriate to question your relationship with Dory.
Yeah.
Not at all. Not one bit. I don't think, if anybody's listened to your podcast, it's very clear you did not vote for Trump. Right?
I don't know how many times I have to say it before I called a Trump supporter.
Even it doesn't matter.
That's
right?
My
it
thing
doesn't
too, is
matter.
Like, yeah.
So I don't know how that played in. I know this is what's wrong with what we've got going on right now.
Yeah.
We've lost the idea that people can disagree and learn something from that and that we get back to some sort of common sense. It's now like I am firmly going to plant myself in this camp and you're going to firmly plant yourself in this camp. And society, Washington State, doesn't know what to do with those of us that live in the middle, right? You're red or blue. We don't like purple at all,
yeah.
Which just doesn't serve our purpose. And we see it in what's happening in our legislature. We see it's what's happening in our communities that there's no middle ground. And that's what occurred there. And it's very frustrating to me.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I think you and I are both people who want to do away with performative politics, just get back to this point where, like, we should be able to sit in a room with people who we don't agree with. And I don't care if people aren't moderate. I don't need everybody to be a moderate. But I think even if you're on the left or the right, being willing to come in and say, okay, let's be reasonable, let's realize that working together is going to lead to a better result. I guess, how do we push past? Because I really feel like there's this, especially this feeling in Washington, that any hint of right is wrong. Yeah. That if you are, because there are some things that I'm on the right on, you know, spending and crime, you know, law and order. And to think that even if I had voted for Donald Trump or was a Trump supporter, that like that, then I'm not worthy of women, like being empowered as a woman. How do you think we get past this point where we decide how we feel about someone purely based on our perception of their politics?
Yeah. I think it's all of us that believe that standing up and saying something. And it's an uncomfortable space. It is. I sit in rooms all the time with, with folks that have very different opinions than me. And you, everybody just sort of have this like, oh, should I say anything? It's probably not going to rock the boat. We have to start standing up for what the right thing is. People ask me all the time, like, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? And the example that I give, when I ran for mayor in my first term, I was this crazy left-wing, off the charts left side, because my opponent was clearly more to the right. When I ran last time, my opponent was much further to the left, so I was a crazy Republican out there, right wing, and I'm like, I have not changed one bit.
Yep.
So that leaves everybody to decide. What I think that says is I'm doing a really good job of taking care of my city.
Yeah.
It means that I am not letting politics come into play. I don't have to choose. It's a nonpartisan office. And for me, being in the middle means I'm serving my entire city.
Yeah. And one of the things that the whole mission of this show and like leaving my job and all that is to try to get people who are, and again, they don't have to be moderates, but people who are living in that, what I call like reality zone, where they realize the world doesn't revolve around their political beliefs. You have to be willing to hear people out. I just want them to find their voice and I want them to be brave enough to speak out because we really are the majority.
We are. There's no question.
No question. But the fringes are so loud and scary and like they will name call to high heaven that it's like, why wouldn't you? I mean, I do this. You're a mayor. Yeah. It's easier. We're used to speaking out. Right. But I think for people, citizens who aren't living a public life, it's very hard for them to work up the courage to speak out. So what would your message be to people who feel like we do, but who just haven't found it in them yet to make their voices heard?
It is very gratifying to be able to speak your mind, and the world won't end, right? Yes. I think that there's this belief, we live in cancel culture.
Yeah.
Like one, you do one thing wrong, everything you have done goes away. Back in beginning of 22, I did a video clip about some things that were really weighing on my heart. And it was, people do 100 right things, whether you're talking about somebody that does a podcast or is a public figure, a mayor, or just everyday people. We do 100 things right. And then one thing happens that somebody disagrees with, and then that person's, they're disposable.
Yep.
That is not an okay place to be. And so I did it. I was talking about the things going on. It was during the pandemic. So it might've been January of 21. City employees, they're coming to work every single day. They're making sure that you get your water and your sewer and that the police are showing up and that your permits are processed. All day long, there's thousands of interactions. And then this one thing will pop up and, oh, we're done, right? It's over. We can't treat people that way. And until we say that over and over again, I don't think people that are not in a place where they can stand up and talk about it, I think that it's not top of mind. And so for me, it's just, you know, give people grace. Everybody's human. We're going to make mistakes. I very much am, you know, we talked about it earlier. I'll stand up and say, I messed up, right? And I'm going to fix it and I'm going to do better. And in other places in life, in sports, you lose. So stand back up and win again. We don't tell the team you should just go away,
yeah.
Right?
Disband.
just we're done. Yep. You lost a game, move on. Yeah. But we do it to people. And I don't think that's okay.
Man, look how deep we're getting on the podcast today. But it is like, it's that old saying, like, would you want to be judged forever and eternity by the worst thing you ever did?
Right.
I wouldn't. I mean, you know, I haven't been a perfect person, so.
Well, and we talk about that in terms of things like our criminal justice system. We don't keep people in jail forever because we're not going to judge them by the worst day of their life. Well, apply that to everybody, yeah. Right? Apply that thought process to people can grow and change, and we need to give them those opportunities. And you never know the whole story, what led to that decision or action. Just grace. Got to give each other grace.
Yeah. Well, Kent Mayor Dana Ralph, I always appreciate just your time and your very like calm perspective on things. Give us a little bit of a taste of your State of the City address.
All right. March 14th, it's at Kent Meridian Performing Arts Center. Doors open at 6:30, starts at 7 o'clock. Really, it's a celebration of the things that have gone well. It's going to be some conversation on how we're going to tackle some of those issues. And a little preview on the sort of the theme. We're going to talk a lot about kindness and what that looks like it's how it's reflected in our everyday actions.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time.
A big thank you to Kent Mayor Dana Ralph for sitting down with us and for being a truth teller in our community. She is a politician that I think a lot of other public servants could learn something from. I'll see you all on Wednesday as we sit down with our next truth teller. And remember, subscribers have early access to all of these special episodes. So if you haven't already, sign up on Patreon, patreon.com/undivided, or become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com.